the opening pages of the Bach Magnificat in D, a moment which sends a shiver of musical ecstasy through one of the most successful and certainly the most prolific playwright of our age. If I were to try and list all his hits, we'd lose half the programme, so I'll simply say that he's Alan Ayckbourn. Does that first tingle have any meaningful associations with religion or the church, or is it purely a musical one?
It's purely musical. I came to Bach by way of the popular music that I started listening to when I was a kid, and then worked backwards via Beethoven. But the first time I heard Bach, it just tingled me. I mean, all Bach tingles me. That particularly gives me the most incredible thrill.
Your father was the leader of the London Symphony Orchestra. How responsible was he for your early musical tastes?
Well, he retired both from my life, because he went off and married somebody else rather than my mother, and also he retired from the London Symphony Orchestra fairly early in life. But I suspect that in my very formative sort of pram years, there was a lot of music in the house, a lot of musicians as well. And I was probably exposed to an awful lot of quotes, good music when I was a kid. Although I inherited none of his talent, I cannot play a note.
But how old were you when he left home?
Seven. By that time, I went only to visit him in holidays. But he still continued to play me records. And my mother, of course, was a music lover. And so I was very lucky. I mean, there was music around without it being foisted upon me, which I think is the best way for any child to come to music.
At the last count, you've written something around 50 published and unpublished plays. How did you first discover you could write them?
Again, by parental example. As we mentioned, my father, my mother wrote very successfully for women's magazines. And indeed, between husbands, she was the main breadwinner in the family. And I got very used to seeing her writing, which paid the rent. And a typewriter on the kitchen table was the norm rather than a rolling pin. So I very rapidly began to sort of copy her and wrote my own little pieces. I had a typewriter at the age of seven, really. And by about 15, I was beginning to move towards drama, which I think must have come back to my grandparents. My grandmother, maternal grandmother, was a male impersonator. And my grandfather was apparently, by all accounts, I may malign him, a monumentally awful Shakespearean actor. But anyway, there was the theatre and the blood. And back it came on my generation. I really wanted to act from the age of 17. Wrote my first play, I think, around about the age of 19. Specifically for me to act in. I mean, it was just a shameless vehicle. But as the writing in me got better and the acting in me stayed resolutely the same, I think I inherited my grandfather's talent as well, I began to ditch the acting, and the writing developed. And it was quite a gradual thing. I wrote naturally comedies, which is something that most new writers don't start with. They start with the serious stuff. Why my parents ruined my childhood and things. So I was very fortunate. I became instantly commercial. And £41 for one's first play was a fortune in 1959.
Let's have your next choice.
My next choice is Prokofiev, the Violin Concerto, number one, which I heard the end of a long, long time ago on a prom, and was absolutely captivated by a style of music I'd never really known before. And I became a Prokofiev addict overnight. But this is a sort of really daring end to a concerto. I mean, it just goes up and up and floats away, and it doesn't have the usual, what the endings I was used to in Beethoven, the sort of the 10-minute chords. Most exciting and a wonderful mixture of bittersweet romanticism, which I love. He writes like I'd like to write.
Thank you. Yitzhak Perlman and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gennady Rozhdestvensky, and the end of the Prokofiev First Violin Concerto. How do you listen to music? Can you work with it in the background, or do you have to sit down and listen to it properly, as they say?
I don't actually like it in the background. I would hate it if people had my plays on in the background while they were working. And I tend actually to listen to it quite seriously, which makes for a lot of inertia. But I find it very useful as a way of recharging as much as anything. It reaches parts that other things cannot reach, as it were. And so I do set aside usually at least an hour a day to listen to music with nothing else.
Deliberately?
Yes, yes. Especially sort of after dinner or something like that. I tend to do that rather than watch television and things where I think I'm dealing with words and people all day. Mm. And to get into something as abstract as music. And something I, on the one hand, deeply love and yet really don't understand. And it's like it remains a completely mystical experience.
And you must do most of your listening at home here in Scarborough. I mean, you're reputed not to be terribly keen on London life, so you must miss out on a lot of live music, don't you?
I do. The miracle of CDs and the fact that I've been able to afford a rather large sound system to some extent makes up to it. Of course, you can't beat real live music, and whenever I am down, I try and see at least a couple of concerts. As I like watching the orchestra, too. I think it's the most exciting sight, a full orchestra coming on and tuning up, and, which you miss on a CD. It just starts. I find that a very exciting addition. The music is also a visual thing.
The Vivaldi, Motetto per la Solennità. How did you come to hear this?
I think browsing through CD racks at my local store. And I sort of collected any Vivaldi I could find. And I had a great passion for him, still do. And this struck me as being a little treasure of a disc, and it's something I didn't know at all. And this particular section it must be the shortest and happiest piece of music I've ever heard. I have a theory that great art has to be written to something bigger than you. And this is an Alleluia, which is obviously written to someone he considered far bigger than him. And it shows. It leaves his body when you listen to it, and it lifts me up with him.
Per la Solennità by Vivaldi, Cecilia Gazdia and I Solisti Veniti, conducted by Claudio Scimoni. Alan Ayckbourn, you have had the stab at the odd musical show, haven't you? Is writing one very different from writing a play?
Yes, it is. I mean, my role has been mainly book writer, libretto, because lyrics are something I have been practicing at, but they are an extraordinary art form. And I don't kid myself that anyone who writes plays can write lyrics. I've had sort of mixed success. I mean, there was the huge mega disaster I had some years ago. which is now quite a distinction to have actually brought Andrew Lloyd Webber a failure.
this was Jeeves.
Jeeves, yes, which sank with all hands and almost ruined P.G. Wodehouse with it. But since then, I've practiced a little bit up here with a collaborator called Paul Todd, and he and I have written songs quite a lot. We've written over 100 songs together now.
Your next thrill could hardly be more in contrast to the Vivaldi and the Bach we've had so far. This is pop music. Is this an example of the way that your children have influenced you?
Yes, indeed. They usually arrive at Christmas with about 3 or 4 records, which I hate as soon as I hear them, and then play them for the rest of the year, and by the end I've bought the rest of them. This is Tom Waits, who I discovered a few months back. I love music that has a sense of humour to it, and this man is always got some portion of his tongue in his cheek. This is probably one of his more serious numbers, but he has me howling with laughter because he does write the most extraordinary arrangements, gets away with the most ghastly lyrics occasionally, but is sung with such aplomb and with a voice that sounds as if he's come out of a tool chest somewhere, that inevitably he wins me round every time, and no two songs of his are remotely connected.
Number, please. It's been so many years. She remembered my old voice while I fight the tears. Hello, hello, there is this Martha, this is old Tom Frost. And I am calling long distance. Don't worry about the cost. It's been 40 years or more now, Martha, please recall. Meet me out for coffee, where we'll talk about it all. And those were days of roses, poetry and prose, and Martha, all I had was you, and all you had was me.
Tom Waits with Martha. What about outgrowing classical music? I mean, I have to confess that some works, and even great works, I'll go as far as to say the odd Beethoven symphony, that I really don't want to visit again unless the performance itself is quite out of the ordinary. Do you suffer from that syndrome too?
Yes, I'm not sure. I would say yes, and then I think as soon as I hear it, I melt again. Mm. I wouldn't care if you asked me just now to sit down and listen to Beethoven's Fifth very much. Mm. Certainly not on a disc. But I suspect if I did sit down and it started, once I got through the opening, which I think, you know, it has really been done to death, certainly in my view, I would then begin to be caught up with the old boy, and I should think by about halfway through the slow movement I'd be a sucker for anything. And I think it often does it to your music. There's a lot of it that I think I wouldn't enjoy because I've heard it a lot. I remember a really hackneyed piece, Scheherazade, and the Rimsky-Korsakov, and I thought, no, I really don't want to hear that again until the day I die, you know, I really don't. And I caught it somewhere on radio, I think, and I just sat down and I got so carried away, and I thought, this is wonderful, there's brass bits at the end. And I thought, why did I say this about this? I'm terribly sorry, Rimsky, you know. Beg your pardon.
Me again. For how long have you been in love with your next choice, the Mendelssohn Octet?
Oh, this really is a time and a place. When I started in my theatre career, one of the places I worked was at the Oxford Playhouse, which was run then by Frank Hauser. And I was put in charge of what was then the panatrope, you know, the gramophone to play the effects. And Frank always liked a little music to play the audience in with. But what Frank wasn't prepared to do was to buy any records. And we only had 3. and one of them was the Enchanted Toy Shop. And this piece, which I didn't know, the Mendelssohn Octet. So every third show, we'd play the Mendelssohn Octet. And I got to know it awfully well. And I didn't, again, think I'd want to hear it again very much, as I put it on every night and it got scratchier and scratchier. But I heard it again, you know, some years later, and my eyes filled with tears, and I sat down and thought, oh, I remember those dear young days when I was an ASM. And it's full of memory. Wonderful piece. Hear the curtain going up there, at least I can.
Yes. Vienna Octet in that recording. Alan Ayckbourn, you're not only a playwright, you're also a very successful theatre director and of other people's plays too. I don't think I'll ever forget your wonderful production of Arthur Miller's View from the Bridge at the National Theatre. How open-minded are you when you begin rehearsals? I mean, how much do you allow your original concept to be influenced by the actors?
As much as possible. Stephen Joseph, who was my mentor, who started the theatre in Scarborough, I once asked him, when he asked me to do my first production, I asked him what the secret was about directing. I mean, can you give me a quick crash course? And he said, all you've got to remember is to create an atmosphere in which the actors can feel free to create, which, of course, is the most difficult thing, because no two actors create the same. But I do try to give certainly to give them the impression that there are no hard, clear-cut decisions made that would forbid them doing certain things of their own. I mean, because after all, it is an actor's contribution that one's looking for. And I suppose the skill of a director is somehow, having seen the potential in the contributions, is to draw them together so that they're unified, that you don't get six completely disparate views of the play. But good actors often do it for you, if you let them. They know what they're doing. They'd like you as a sounding board, and they obviously one makes one's own contribution to them.
Well, your next tingles are non-musical. Tell me about these two.
One of the good things, we mentioned Jeeves the musical, and one of the good things that came out of that particular show was A Burmese Cat, which Andrew gave me. Andrew Lloyd Webber at this point had about four or five Burmese cats, and this cat was a very antisocial cat, called Bollinger, of all things, because he was champagne-coloured. So I inherited him at a very young age, and he immediately got known as Bolly.
He gave you his worst cat.
Yes. Well, he said he'd be all right without the other cats. He's 14 years old and still going strong. And we got passionately attached to him. And he's written a few plays with me in his time. He sometimes sits in his basket next to the word processor, which is very warm when I'm writing, and purrs as I write if something's going very well. So he's a great co-writer and never, never contradicts what I want to do.
Well, that's the nearest we could get to Bollinger himself, who probably wouldn't appear today on our behalf. And the next one is an obvious passion, because I've read you up in Who's Who. It's cricket, isn't it?
Yes, I love cricket. I was a very slow, reflexed wicketkeeper for some years. When we played a lot up here. We formed our own teams and played the Yorkshire Villages, which was great fun. But this is an Australian appeal. One of the most feared noises, I think, for any batsman, particularly English batsman, this summer. But I think they're most exciting cricketers, and I love to see them beaten, but I like to see them play as well.
Moves in now. Bolsness a little bit shorter outside the outcome. He's out. He's shuffled across, played on the back foot.
Well, not a great tingle for the English team, as you said. You're very particular about the artist in the next work, the French pianist Cécile Houssay playing Poulenc. Was it her performance which introduced you to it?
Yes, it was, and I got very attached to the way she played it. I mean, I have heard it played, obviously, by other people since, but I love this music. It is, again, romantic. It reminds me a lot of the sort of 1930, 40 Renoir films that I used to see. It has that same sort of rather filmic quality about it. I used it, actually, in a production of a Chekhov adaptation, which we did last summer. By a man called Frank Dunay, which was a play called The Parasol. And it fitted, as sometimes music does, it fitted the production so perfectly. And I also was inadvertently introduced to a lot of Scarborough the music of Poulenc, which was apparently a mystery to them, and the box office
cursed me forever for people ringing up, not for tickets, but to find out what the music was last night. And if I'd been his agent, I'd have made a very fat cut out of selling his music.
Cécile Houssay playing the Poulenc Piano Concerto with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Rudolf Barschai. I'm saying all that so that we don't get letters to the box office asking what it was. We're coming to the end of our conversation, and of course one always tries to save the stickiest questions until the end. So, looking back on what you've done so far, which of your achievements makes you most proud?
Oh dear. Becoming a Freeman of the Borough of Scarborough, I think, comes pretty high. I'm now able to march down the high street with a drawn sword if I wanted to. I can't think of any other advantage. I immediately said, does it give me free parking? Which is obviously the most important.
Did you get anything else?
Yes. No, nothing at all. And I suppose, seriously, to have gone into the National and run a company there was rather nice, and to have had a degree of success with the big lads. But I suppose the main achievement is, if I'm proudest of anything, it's keeping this theatre, the Stephen Joseph Theatre, going after 20 years as director nearly. We've worked with some wonderful people here, and we've done some good work in a town, I suppose, that's not immediately recognisable as being the centre of the theatrical universe. Seaside town on the end of a railway line. That's probably the proudest.
And how are you going to finish our talk today?
Well, I'll finish it with a piece of outrageously theatrical music, if you like, The Britain's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, which I heard very early on in life, and it reminds me of my dad, who of course played in the orchestra, and I still find orchestras sort of magic pieces of equipment. There's so many people all working to the same end. It's like theatre writ large, and there's something that Britain gets in this which has that childlike excitement in the nuts and bolts of orchestral playing, and the way they all come together is, for me, in the fugue bits, is just, you know, captivating. I get real tingles.